Call this meeting of Labor and Industry, Finance and Policy to order. Today is Thursday, April 4th. First order of business is Representative Jordan, as we were discussing about the minutes. You have a motion for me?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I did note that Mr. Killian from the MAC was absent from the list of testifiers on House File 4659, so I would move to add him and then approve the minutes.
4818.
Yes. 4818. Thank you.
With that correction, all in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. The minutes are approved. We have two bills we're dealing with today here, and in the first bill is Representative Curran's bill, and I'll move that we hear House File 4713 and have it re-referred to the Health and Finance Policy Committee. Welcome to the committee, Representative. You want to explain your bill?
Yes, thank you so much, Chair, for hearing House File 4713 today, and thank you, committee members, for your time. House File 4713 is a bill in response to compliance issues with water gremlin, which is in my community, and this particular bill addresses blood lead levels of its employees. Water gremlin was a manufacturer of battery terminals and lead fishing weights. They have since gone out of business, but the effects are unfortunately lasting and devastating to my community. This bill would specifically direct the Commissioner of Labor and Industry in consultation with the Commissioner of Health to adopt rules to lower acceptable blood lead levels of employees. And this came about in 2017 when elevated blood lead levels of employees' children had surfaced, but no laws since had changed. The children of workers who had considered to have an acceptable range of blood lead levels suffered from impairment as a result of the exposure to the adults who had a quote acceptable range of lead in their blood. I'll note that currently Minnesota's OSHA standards say that an employee must be removed when blood lead levels reach 50 units and can return to work when blood lead levels reach below 40 units. However, the CDC states that even 5 units can lead to decreased renal function, and a blood lead level of 10 units is associated with increased blood pressure and hypertension. As we know, there is no safe blood lead concentration. However, this legislation will work to create a new acceptable level based on current data on the effects of lead. In your packets, members, you should see a letter of support from the Neighborhood Concerned Citizen Group. This group, also called NCCG, was formed specifically in response to water gremlin's effects on our community, not just through worker exposure, but initially through contamination in nearby neighborhoods. When earlier concerns were raised due to environmental contamination, workers then began to come forward to offer their experiences bringing lead into their homes. Various pieces of legislation in the past have addressed several issues uncovered affecting community members near the water gremlin facility. And now we're specifically addressing concerns with worker exposure and the effects on those employees and their families. We know that this important work in state legislature often comes directly from our community members, and this bill is a result of my community's diligence and continued efforts. I'll note just that this bill has had 2 hearings in the Senate and had a testimony from an employee of Water Gremlin for nearly 26 years, migrated lead unknowingly on his clothes, and had mentioned that he had noticed coworkers who had left seemingly to go on vacation only to find out they never returned, and in some cases found out folks had died of cancer. And when trying to advocate for change, this employee was not only met with challenges as a whistleblower, but was also met with physical threats and violence from management. We did hear some opposition in the Senate, and that was primarily from battery manufacturing companies, as we might expect. They agreed with the general concept, believed this is not the right approach, but I would argue that this is exactly the right approach. Minnesota tends to be a leader when we protect people and protect our environment. And if not now, when? And how many more cases do we need to happen? How many more communities need to be affected before we take action and be a leader? And in this case, Minnesota actually would be a follower of a few other states who've managed to make this positive change, but we would still lead the rest of the country. I'll just finally note that this bill passed, again, two committees, Labor and State Gov, in the Senate, with no audible dissent, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Before I do that, is there anybody that needs to speak on this bill, for or against? Seeing no one rushing to the dais, discussion. Member discussion. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Curran, for bringing this bill forward. I think this is a great bill. I guess I would like to, I don't know that anyone from Minn-OSHA is here. Is anyone from Minn-OSHA here?
Yes.
I have a few questions for Minn-OSHA, if that's the case.
If you want to come down and please identify yourself for the tape and then proceed. We'll get her to ask your question.
Hello, everyone. My name is Ron Anderson. I'm the health director with Minnesota OSHA, and I'm happy to answer any questions for you.
Representative Jordan.
Great, thank you. So when we talk about what an elevated blood lead level would mean for a worker that you oversee, what would that be in, what would that be? I mean, would it be what we have as an elevated, what we have defined as an elevated blood lead level in statute? Would it be different for adults versus children? So what would you, in the rulemaking process, how would you determine what an elevated blood level is?
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you. Currently in our regulation, there are two regulations, one in general industry and one in the construction field. Currently it's either one sample over 60 micrograms per deciliter or perhaps in some cases two samples over 50, which would be considered at a level where the employee needs to be removed from lead exposure until that blood lead level is reduced to below 40. And as I understand it, that current bill is asking us to reduce both the level at which they're removed from exposure to lead and the level at which they can return to work.
Representative Jordan.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. We do have a standard for what an elevated blood lead level is in statute. Last year, a bill was passed that I wrote, House File 92, that lowered that to 3.5 micrograms per deciliter of blood, so I would just encourage you to look at that and use that in determinations. And then I guess the other thing is how would you be doing this testing? Would it be as a result of an exposure? Would it be at the behest of an employee? How would you start the surveillance for blood lead levels in employees, or would it be part of a routine, sort of a routine inspection?
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you. Currently, our standard requires employers that have employees exposed to, in general industry, 30 days or more exceeding our action level, and that's an airborne level, 30 micrograms per cubic meter of air. In the construction industry, it's one day exceeding that 30 microgram limit. It requires an employer to begin that medical surveillance, that type of program. That is something that could be looked at as well.
Great, thank you.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you. And then finally, I have a question for Representative Curran, and it would be, what level of exposure to lead is safe for humans?
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Jordan. No amount of lead is safe for humans.
Thank you.
Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Chair. And this question is maybe for the author. I'm sorry, I'm not for sure. But the federal OSHA is going to be coming out with some standards. Do you happen to know when that's going to be coming down, anytime soon? I know it's been going on for years, so any projections of when?
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and I appreciate the question, Representative Daniels, and that's exactly why we have this bill before us today, is because there is an ongoing process at the federal level, but the problem still stands, and it hasn't been addressed. And so what we're seeking to do with this bill is to have Minnesota establish what those or lower, excuse me, the acceptable range, because the federal range has not changed. And in some cases where we've seen other states try to lower this, like California and Washington, it had taken over 10 years. And you can imagine the amount of damage that could happen to not just one family, but a variety of families in our communities over the course of 10 years without, you know, without mitigating this issue. So, I would say that the length of time that it's taking at the federal level is exactly why we're doing this at the state level now. And I would also note that regardless of where, you know, where federal OSHA lands on this as far as acceptable levels, Minnesota's standard, if it is more strict than the federal level, we would still be fine with what we've established there. Just we wouldn't be able to have a threshold that is less than what the federal OSHA would require.
Representative Daniels.
Thank you for that. I appreciate that. It's very critical. We get all these lead pipes replaced, and you know, we're kind of still in the process of that. But I hate to get too far in front of the game when we don't know what the federal level standard is going to be. It'll be higher or lower, and then we'd have to reevaluate this and come back again and do that. So my just is let's use caution so we don't have to do this twice. And I know it's been gone for years, but I kind of like the old saying, one and done, you know, do it right the first time. So that's my only comment.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Any questions? I just, Representative Kern, I remember stories from my grandfather who talked about the old timers and the businesses they'd have when they worked in places like this. They would shower after work, and he would bring his, the story is he would take the streetcar to work on Mondays and home on Saturdays, and he walked back and forth the rest of the time. But that was so he could bring his work clothes to work that he changed into at work and then bring them home on Saturday night so they could be washed. And that kind of practice has gone away in all industries, that people wear the same clothes they wear at work all day long and then go home or go to the bar afterwards or whatever, but they're bringing some of that stuff home with them and exposing the rest of their families to it. And I don't know if that old practice might be something we strive to do, but that's, like I said, that's just stories from my grandfather. He was a cabinet maker, worked in a shop, and would, like I said, he'd take the streetcar to work on Mondays and home on Saturdays. And the rest of the week, being a thrifty Swede, would walk back and forth to work. So any further discussion? Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in hearing this, Representative Curran, do they take a test at the beginning to know if they have had lead exposure potentially? I mean, Representative Jordan has been advocating to get rid of these lead pipes in homes, but so is there a baseline established before they, at the beginning of employment?
Mr. Anderson, it looks like you can answer that.
Certainly. The OSHA standard would require it if they exceed those thresholds of airborne exposure. An employer could choose to do an initial test. That type of thing. An employer can go beyond our requirements, so they could do it that way. Our standard would not kick in until they cross those thresholds.
Okay. Any further questions? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 4713 be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The bill's on its way. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
The next bill on our agenda is House File, get the number right here, 2513. Representative Hansen, Jay, welcome to the committee. Please, I'll move House File. This bill is we're hearing and laying it over. So I'll move House File 2513 to be laid over for possible consideration in the future. Welcome to the committee. Please explain your bill.
Thank you, Chair. And I do have a DE author's amendment.
I'll move the DE2 amendment. And you want to explain what that amendment does?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, the DE author's amendment gets the bill in the shape that I would like. We've done a lot of work on this bill last year. And so the amendment removes the work we've already done and leaves the work that's left to do.
Okay. Questions on the amendment? Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, just curious if Representative Hanson-Jay could just quickly, just briefly, indicate what work that was done and then what is going to be added on with your amendment. And maybe that's in your opening statement, Representative. If it is, then I'll acquiesce to that.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. Yes, it is in my comments that I'll do a brief overview as fast as I can of the work that we've already done. So if you would like, I can include it there, or I can go over it now, whatever the chair.
If you want to explain the bill with him, and then we can, because that's what it looks like to me is we're deleting everything, and then we're just putting this one piece in.
Mm-hmm. And so all that, oh, I'm sorry.
So go ahead.
All that's left in the amendment, members and chair, is the phase out to effectively say that the end date for the use of subminimum wage is in 2028. That's the last part of what's left to do. We've done the work to create programs, supportive services, create bridging and funding for the existing providers of what's in the bill pre-amendment.
Representative Hanson, or Representative McDonald.
No, I'm good, thank you.
Okay,
Mr. Chair.
Any further questions on the amendment? All in favor of the DE2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The amendment, the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Again, I guess Representative Hanson, I have a list of testifiers. You've kind of explained the bill now. Do you need to explain it? Further explanation or?
Yes, I would like to, Chair. Okay.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members. House File 2513, as amended, will end the use of subminimum wages for people with disabilities in Minnesota by 2028. I want to start by acknowledging that this can be a really complex policy issue and area for some folks that haven't been involved in the step-to-step process. So today in my testimony, I'm going to do my best to summarize 90 years of history and several years of work that's been done in Minnesota and bring you up to speed. So I know that this committee understands the importance of minimum wages in our economy for all people. But unfortunately, nearly 3,500 people with disabilities in Minnesota do not have minimum wage protections. This number could continue to grow under existing law, but we are happy to report that this number is shrinking slowly and surely as we continue to pursue this legislation. But today, we need your help and support to implement the phase out once and for all so that workers with disabilities can receive a dignified wage for the work that they are doing. Eliminating the use of subminimum wages will help pull more people with disabilities out of poverty. Disability waivers help people with disabilities get housing and services, but these waivers barely cover the bare necessities. People with disabilities use shampoo, eat Chipotle, go to coffee with their friends, they like vacations, and then enjoy the little things in life just like everyone else. But their waivers certainly do not cover these expenses and many, many more. So raising the minimum wage for these workers will directly ensure that fewer people with disabilities have to live in poverty and can have a dignified wage for their labor. So a little background for you. 14C exemptions were put in place in the 1930s. They're a federal exemption that shelters special providers and employers from being required to pay people with disabilities minimum wage from their work. The concept is that people with disabilities are to be paid wages that are commensurate with their production, which, to be honest, from the disability community, is a dog whistle way to say that people with disabilities are not capable of doing the work that's as valuable as what other people do. This archaic law means that people with disabilities can be paid as little as 7 cents per hour in Minnesota, surely because the work that they are doing or the provider who helps them perform the job is perpetuating the myth, whether intentionally or not, that disability is a justifiable reason to not dignify the work of minimum wage reimbursement. I'll quickly fill you in on what we've done so far and why in Minnesota. The federal government is actively working on considerations to eliminate 14C contracts, and so our work in Minnesota has been very intentional so that we can get ahead of the feds to be sure that we don't fall victim to some federal changes that we have little ability to influence or customize for our specific Minnesota situation. In 2021, the legislature created a task force to develop a plan to eliminate the use of subminimum wage. In 22, extensive community collaboration was done and a report was prepared identifying all of the work that went into the task force. In 23, we received a report and the governor's recommendation, and we began implementing the recommendations. Our first steps last year were to invest millions of dollars to create programs and bridges to support the providers who help people with disabilities get or perform their jobs, to ensure that they had the financial support they needed to move away from the use of subminimum wage. We gave providers exactly what they asked for, and this year we're asking to finish the job by putting an end date in the statute, which is what's before you today. You will hear arguments about my bill stating that passing this will result in people with disabilities losing employment opportunities, losing socialization opportunities, or losing access to jobs that they really like. And unfortunately, I have to be the one to tell you that this argument has been used for nearly 90 years, and neither subjective nor objective data can support the argument. Many providers who help people with disabilities get and perform in their jobs have successfully moved away from using subminimum wages and have found great success in the transition. I encourage you to review the letters that were submitted to you in this committee and in others to see examples of that. And as a reminder, the phase out that we're asking for is in 2028, and that means that we will be in a new presidential battle by the time we see this phase out in Minnesota. We've already implemented the safety nets necessary to ensure that no one is left behind. But do not worry, we stand ready and open to continually addressing this as the years go on and integrating our disability community into the services that we will need to make or any changes we need to make in the meantime before 2028. I have great faith in this body and the advocates that have been working on this issue to effectively inform us of any issues that they see coming up as we approach that 2028 date. And with that, I thank you for your time, and I will turn it over to testifiers here.
And I have a list of testifiers here. First person on my list is Ethan Vogel. And welcome to the committee. You know the drill, state your name for the record, and you can proceed.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon, members. My name is Ethan Vogel. I serve as Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5. I'm here to speak in favor of House File 2513. Our union supports the elimination of all subminimum wages in our state, including the subminimum wage for workers with disabilities. Thank you, Representative Hansen, for your work and advocacy on this and other issues to lift up working people. AFSCME is a public and private sector labor union, and at Council 5, we represent roughly 43,000 working people across all of Minnesota. We believe that there is dignity in all work, and there should be dignity, prosperity, and opportunity for all workers. Unfortunately, some of our laws on the books still impede working people from attaining basic dignity for the work that they do. And yes, among them is the provision of the law that was passed in 1938 to allow workplace discrimination based on a disability. The lion's share of the Fair Labor Standards Act, the provisions to protect children, to set a minimum wage, to establish the 40-hour work week, to establish the overtime protections, were nothing short of monumental for the vast majority of working people in America. But this law was not perfect. And for the more than 10% of Americans living with a disability today, the provision to allow a subminimum wage for their labor is discriminatory, it's disrespectful, and it's nothing short of archaic. AFSCME members get the protections and the security that comes with having a union-negotiated contract, whether they are an able-bodied person or not. But some AFSCME members, through the course of their working careers with previous employers, have been subjected to this outdated law and paid based on their disabilities rather than their abilities. It's been 86 years. It's 2024, and in the great state of Minnesota, we have the power, the resources, and the resources to support people, to see beyond a disability and identify their strengths and capabilities and to find suitable employment for the individual that where they can thrive. People with disabilities want to work, and they can work. They are capable and wise and resilient and strong, and they have unique and valuable skills based on their own lived experiences. They deserve dignity, and they deserve prosperity, and they deserve opportunity the same as every other worker. I have a three-year-old son at home, and one of my favorite parts of this phase of life is how he tells me all the things that he can do. He can run really fast, and he can lift really heavy things. And he's got a little brother, and as brothers do sometimes, they quarrel, right? So he'll occasionally push his little brother down, and he'll take a toy for no reason or spit in his face sometimes. And I'll say, why did you do that? And he'll say, well, I can because I'm bigger. And so I'll often find myself telling my three-year-old, just because you can doesn't mean you should. I don't know if the moral message in that sinks in with a three-year-old. The latest reports indicate that it doesn't, but I'm hoping it resonates here. Just because federal law allows us to pay people with disabilities less doesn't mean we should. It doesn't make it right. Please support the repeal of the subminimum wage. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vogel. And as a person that has two brothers, we still don't always get along. The next person on my list is Sue Hanker. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and thanks for this opportunity to testify today. I have something to present today, but this little story about a three-year-old. I have two sons. I wish they had had those same experiences, but they didn't have that same opportunity. And 50 years later, they still don't have that same opportunity to be like a three-year-old. Sorry, just get a little emotional there. I'm Sue Hankner with 18 Minnesota, a community of people with significant intellectual or developmental disabilities, their families, and community partners. We support a full array of disability service options and informed choice. Our community has been marginalized by DHS and disability organizations pushing to eliminate work option choice. They want you to think that as families, we do not know what is best for our disabled family member. Many simply discard the existence of our loved ones. Those disability organizations excluded representation on their subminimum wage task force of our family members and us. They pushed the most affected by the work of the task force to the sidelines. They didn't want us involved in planning our future. We reached out to ARC Minnesota last year and hosted a meeting seeking common ground. We got a cold shoulder response. I have two sons with significant, and I want to emphasize significant intellectual and developmental disabilities. They are 45 and 50 years old. I have 50 years of lived experiences with my sons and in the study of human development and the psychology of learning. My two sons' cognitive and language development and physical speaking ability via speech is extremely limited. They look to and depend on their family to advocate for them. We are appalled and offended with the arrogance, the intentional disregard, and the lack of comprehensive planning that further marginalizes a vulnerable community of people with significant cognitive and developmental disabilities. House File 2513 mandates that people with significant cognitive disabilities be paid minimum wage in 14C center-based work options. So the question is, will the legislature appropriate funds to pay that minimum wage? 14C providers are nonprofit businesses specially created to provide training and jobs for people who are not able to hold a job in the general workforce. Their primary revenue is from federal and state program funds and local fundraising. And I repeat, their primary revenue is from federal and state program funds and local fundraising. You've likely heard about eight Minnesota providers that eliminated special minimum wage. One of those providers bragged to me that their clients are now volunteers and not paid for what they do. Is that the intent? Proponents of this bill failed to mention, in states that eliminated 14C, there is increased unemployment, increased movement to day activity programs, or people isolated in their homes because there is no job and no day activity program available. Is that the intent? What happens to provider services that rely primarily on unique in-house client products to sell? For example, birdhouses. On average, it takes 20 hours for a trained person with a significant intellectual or developmental disability to build a birdhouse. The birdhouse sells for $35. Assuming 20 hours at $10.85 minimum wage, the cost to make the birdhouse is $217, resulting in a loss of $182 per birdhouse before considering payroll taxes. Unanswered questions to consider. How can the nonprofit provider sustain its operations and facilities at a loss? Who makes up the $182 loss per birdhouse? Will the legislature appropriate funds for this purpose? These work options are in accepting and integrated or supporting, I'm sorry, they, these work options are in accepting and supporting integrated communities. They offer integrated employment as defined by the individual, not by anyone else. Does the worker lose their chosen job in their choice of setting? What occurs in the worker's community support plans and their informed choice? Is the worker forced into day activities or volunteer work instead of a chosen work option? How is informed choice of people with significant intellectual or developmental disabilities respected and honored? Will the proposed legislation force 14C nonprofit providers to close their programs? Their plan is to dole out grant dollars to providers that submit to their will, and there is no plan to find individuals with significant intellectual or developmental disabilities jobs in the general workforce. As a parent, what I hear from the proponents of House File 2513 is that they know best for our loved ones and to get out of their way. Please, consider the perspective of those that are most affected by the elimination of 14C and the provisions of House File 2513. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. The next person I have is Brian Begin. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brian Begin, and I work for the University of Minnesota Institute on Community Integration. Thanks for the opportunity to testify to ensure people with disabilities are paid at least the minimum wage or higher in Minnesota, where wage justice is a strongly held value and included in our employment first policy. In the past 2 years, MTI, which is the Minnesota Transformation Initiative, has supported seven providers to relinquish their 14C special wage certificate. These seven providers have all completed a robust transition plan with support from MTI. No one has lost services because of their provider's transformation. Rather, individuals are receiving employment and day support services that they have not had access to before. All providers have developed plans for a sustainable business model that does not rely on subminimum wages, and none have expressed concern about their ability to stay open. The Minnesota Legislature has made funding available for the foreseeable future to continue the work to help service providers with this powerful, equitable transformation. There's not a one-size-fits-all plan to this work. The technical assistance that MTI provides looks different for every provider. We visit the organization, we meet with their leadership, we learn about their service model, and then work together to build their transition plan. MTI provides extensive, impactful trainings on a range of topics related to expanding community employment and organizational transformation. We also support peer mentorship by connecting providers that are in the process of ending payment of subminimum wages with those who have successfully made that transition and who are providing community employment services. The University of Minnesota's Institute on Community Integration strongly supports the plan to ensure wage justice in Minnesota and pay all people with disabilities the minimum wage or higher. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. The next person I have is Matt Feed. Welcome to the committee. Again, state your name for the record and proceed. And I hope I said your name right.
Thede, yes. Chair Nelson and members of the committee, my name is Matt Thede. I live in Minneapolis, and I have been a home care worker for the past 5 years now. I'm a member of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota and Iowa. Our union represents 50,000 healthcare workers who work in hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and self-directed home care. Our union supports this bill to eliminate the subminimum wage for disabled workers. We signed the coalition letter of support, and we would endorse the Minnesota AFL-CIO letter of support. Historically, home care workers, like many service workers, were excluded from the first minimum wage laws because people said that what we did wasn't really work. Our union has always stood for the principle that everyone deserves basic labor protections like the minimum wage. But let me tell you why this is important to me. As a PCA, I benefited from the minimum wage increase to $19 an hour that this legislature passed last year. An earlier PCA contract raised our minimum wage to $15.25 in large part because the state needed to keep up with the Minneapolis minimum wage contract. As someone with my own disabilities, I know how important it is to advocate for wage justice for all people with disabilities. The disability community is one that any of us can join at any time throughout our lives. Equity, respect, and dignity are core values to me. I believe that they are also core Minnesotan values. I am proud to be a union home care worker with SEIU, Healthcare, Minnesota, and Iowa. I am proud to be a part of a community of care and support that leaves no one behind. No one wins as long as the subminimum wage is allowed to continue. Thank you for your consideration of this important issue.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else in the audience that wishes to speak? Come on down. Rick, you were first. Come on down.
It's okay to be last.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Jim Clapper, and I am a parent of a young man with developmental disabilities and a co-founder of 18 Minnesota. Thank you for taking my testimony. I'm sorry I'm late in getting it in, but I just came from out of town. It is critical to maintain the choices people have with intellectual and developmental disabilities and not take away the employment option using special minimum wages under the provision of 14C of the Fair Labor Standards Act. HF 2513 eliminates the utilization of 14C, which will result in irreparable harm for those who currently benefit from this employment choice. Good policies are data-driven, but the ongoing debate about the utilization of special minimum wages in Minnesota does not include much in terms of good data. This leaves various committees in the Minnesota legislature listening to platitudes and anecdotal stories on both sides of the debate. The following are some facts that might be useful. Minnesota has a high utilization of special minimum wages, but we're not the highest. As of January 2nd, 2024, there are 54 certificate holders covering about 3,500 employees. Minnesota is number 5 in the number of people using special minimum wages, with Missouri, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Ohio having more employees under special minimum wages. Even on a per capita basis, Minnesota is number 2 behind Missouri. Section 511 of the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act requires that everybody working under special minimum wages attend a counseling session every year with vocational rehabilitation services to choose whether to seek competitive integrated employment or continue with center-based or community-based employment under special minimum wages. In Minnesota, since 2016, 51,000 counseling sessions have been conducted, and 86% of those sessions have resulted in people staying with special minimum wages. These counseling sessions are mandatory, and those who chose not to attend these annual counseling sessions lose their special minimum wage employment altogether. These state and national policies have contributed to the decline of 14C participation, although there is a good momentum in the remaining states to keep and protect 14C. The Government Accountability Office is currently studying the outcomes of people with IDD in those states where utilization of 14C was eliminated. It released part of a study in early 2023 and continued its study of the Department of Labor throughout 2024. Quote, unquote, resource and logistics limitations restrict movement of people into competitive integrated employment, according to the GAO study. They went on to say that employers who provided comments about the transition to competitive employment described challenges such as few resources to assist the 14C workers with the transition, few opportunities or hours in competitive employment, and difficulties some individuals with more severe disabilities may face in working with competitive employment. In a similar study in Oklahoma, participation in sheltered workshops dropped by two-thirds over this 15-year period. There was no corresponding increase in integrated employment, although the number of subjects who were sitting at home almost tripled. The Congressional Budget Office has studied the potential impacts of S-2488, Raise the Wage Act of 2023, if it is passed. One provision will eliminate 14C at a national level, Taking these factors into account, CBO projects that on net, the Raise the Wage Act of 2023 would reduce employment by increasing amounts over the 2024 to 2029 period. It went on to say the larger mandated wage increases would cause larger increases in joblessness. The increase in joblessness might be relatively large because the disabled workers affected by this section are less productive than the adults who are subject to only Section 2. The state of Maine was an early adopter to eliminating center-based employment centers and utilization of 14C in 2001. George Washington University conducted a study of the long-term impacts of the implementation of this statute. Many of the individuals who were working in sheltered workshops at the time the policy was implemented are no longer working or working fewer hours or doing volunteer work instead of paid work. Washington State was another early adopter in closing center-based employment programs and then eliminated utilization of 14C a few years ago. A 2012 update from Washington State noted that despite the investment of $50 million into employment services for intellectually and developmentally disabled, only 17% severely affected adults were able to find jobs. The evidence is clear. Eliminating the use of special minimum wages or 14C does not raise the majority of people with IDD up to a minimum wage, and it violates the principles of informed choice and person-centered planning. Minnesota does not need to make the same mistakes that 15 other states have made in limiting this employment choice. Thank you for taking my testimony.
Thank you for your testimony, sir. Anybody further? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Nelson and committee members. My name is Jillian Nelson. I am the Community Resource and Policy Advocate for the Autism Society of Minnesota. I am also an autistic adult, and I had the privilege of serving as the co-chair for the Minnesota Legislative Task Force on Eliminating Subminimum Wage. I just wanted to bring some clarification to some of the points we've heard today. The task force did engage with families and community members. We held many listening sessions. We had family members as a part of our task force. I personally sat in these rooms with many families and listened to their fears and listened to their concerns. Overall, when we told the family members of the plan, of the options, of things like medical assistance for employed people with disabilities, of how Social Security worked, of that we're not taking away their choice, we're just asking that people be paid minimum wage, families were overwhelmingly in support of what we were doing. What we have found is that the fear comes from lack of knowledge. They don't realize that there are systems in place that would allow their families to continue receiving their waivers and their Medicaid services. There was a lot of lack of information about how Social Security comes into play with earning more money. And when those families had that information, they were fine with the transformation. Additionally, we are not asking to take away anyone's choice of where they work. I am absolutely would celebrate customized and competitive employment. I would love to see more people with disabilities working in our communities. But I also respect the choice that some people want to go to their day program, want to do their jobs in a sheltered setting with that support one-on-one and in that same place that they receive the rest of their day services. We do not oppose that in any way, shape, or form. We are simply saying that the people in those programs, the same as the people in our communities, need to be paid minimum wage or higher. So we are not taking away a choice of where people are working. We are simply taking away a choice to discriminate against people with disabilities by paying them less than minimum wage. Additionally, we have found that of those providers that have transitioned, some of them, yes, some they are filling their daytime with volunteer work. But none of these people that were in the subminimum wage roles were working 30, 40 hours a week. They were traditionally working 1 to 2 hours a week, making less than minimum wage. The rest of their time was already filled with those day activities such as volunteering or social recreational opportunities or community outings. What we did hear, and I didn't even hear this from our community members, I learned from Representative Fisher. He went and visited one of the programs that received a grant in his community, and he is seeing people thriving making minimum wage or higher. In fact, that program is seeing an uptake of people transferring from other programs into this program because they found out that it's working, that their people, that these family, the people that families are concerned about are being employed, they are making minimum wage or higher in this program, and they are thriving in our communities. We did not set out to do this blindly. We have heard all of the same stats that were just shared with you by the father. That is why Minnesota developed this plan. We did not want to make the mistakes other states have made, so we have developed a long phase out. We have invested in grant opportunities. We have invested in technical assistance, and we have provided support to case managers as well as families in education to make sure that we can be successful. As a person with a disability, I assure you, I would never move forward with a piece of legislation that I thought would harm my peers and my community members. This is very personal to me and to my heart. I may look very different from some of the people parents are talking to you about, but I assure you, I have those family members in my own family, and I carry their value and their worth close to my heart, and I would never proceed with any piece of legislation that I thought would harm my community. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony. Rick? Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, at the Labor, Industry, and Finance Policy Committee. My name is Rick Heller. I unofficially represent twice exceptional Minnesota Statute 120B15, or House File 3299. Also unofficially represent the people with print disabilities found in Senate File 5222, of those that are interested to endorse or support the definitions currently in statute that don't currently have any clear definitions. Last year, the governor changed the word handicap to print disability in the Omnibus Education Bill. So I come to speak today on 3513 bill. I've been involved in labor for a few years, and as I studied labor law, Title 29, Chapter 31, which mentions universal design and digital accessibility. They knew a long time ago, frankly, about that because it was in labor law for people to meet part of the mission statement of special ed law if you need a purpose, but everyone it impacts, which is education, employment for independence. For instance, in this bill, specifically on page 512 or 5.12, and then 511, and then 7.5, mentions the word technology supports.
And Rick, Mr. Heller, with the amendment, that part is gone. The only part of the bill that's left would be on page one, subdivision six. Is that what the amendment did? The rest of the bill is gone. All we're talking about is that piece there.
One thing I do appreciate is when people post their documents online and read them out loud, I can follow along. This meeting currently does not have caption in it, and I do better by seeing and hearing the printed word. I do appreciate those people. I would also ask that in the future that the legislature make sure that those documents are sent to meet the compliance accessibility at the legislature is going to implement in October of 2024. As you know, Mr. Nelson, you were on the 1962 bill in the 2019 session regarding that. As far as me going into the great details, other than this other bill is deleted, I'm not sure if it is, but it's probably part of law. If you can show me it, I frankly do understand a little bit of U.S. labor law. And the loopholes, I do want to stress one thing, frankly. Be carefully and be alert to third-party vendors that are not applying 508 and web content accessibility guidelines to those that are taking the funding. I warn those, including the unions, as well, to include plain language, which is a text complexity of language for its members and the public at large. Thank you again for this opportunity to speak. I do support the repeal and moving this closer to providing a voice which matters and has value, that everyone has a place in the workplace. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Heller, for your discussion. The bill. Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Thank you, Representative Hansen. Thank you to all the testifiers and for the work that you've put in on that. I just have a few questions to better understand the impact of this. Are the employees, besides wages, going to be entitled to any other benefits or miss out on any other benefits because of if this passes into law?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question. There's not any that come to mind right off the top of my head. I would be willing to kind of dissect your question if there's something specifically you may have heard or something you're concerned about. What I have found in this work is that there is a lot of folks who mean a lot of things when they ask me that question. And so for not wanting to overstate or assume what your questions might be, I'd definitely be willing to talk to you now or offline, whatever you would like. But in terms of like Social Security benefits, disability benefits, things like that, some folks are concerned about somebody making more money and potentially having asset limitations come into play in some way, shape, or form. We do not see that working a minimum wage job is going to put folks over asset limits where they do exist. We have worked to eliminate quite a few asset limits, making sure we're addressing some of those things. But as it stands right now, the bridges and supports that we've put in place are to help address any of the questions that come up for lost benefits that we have not thought of already. So we have a safety net there should something come up that we haven't already accounted for as well.
Representative Myers.
Yeah, thank you, and I appreciate that. I mean, we had some testimony here that talked about, you know, the number of hours people are working on average. You know, in the task force or the research that you have done on this, was there any consideration of, instead of getting rid of the standard altogether, of doing some sort of pay increase from what it is right now?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question again. I think we get into tricky, murky waters when we do that, because if we try to set a standard below minimum wage, what is that, and how do we measure that? Minimum wage is that standard that we've already set. There's been conversation about phasing up from potentially as low as 7 cents an hour and maybe saying, well, under a 14C contract, let's say it's $5 an hour. Unfortunately, $5 an hour is still not minimum wage, and it's still not achieving the mission of what we're doing here to, one, treat people with disabilities in the labor environment with equity and dignity, and two, helping more people with disabilities leave poverty. People with disabilities live in some of the deepest, most abject poverty that the vast majority of us cannot comprehend. Not being able to afford your shampoo or other necessities is really hard. But one of the analogies we've heard folks talk about throughout this work is that if I cut my finger in a sheltered work environment, my day's wages won't even cover the cost of a bottle of Neosporin or a box of Band-Aids to cover the Band-Aid. And that's, like, I think, really settling for me to say, you should at least be able to afford that box of Band-Aids if you cut your finger at work. And the severity of this is that those folks can't even afford that.
Representative Myers.
Yeah, and thank you for that. Again, you know, from my perspective and how I look at things, it's always trying to find what the options and opportunities are that gets you to whatever bill you brought forward. And so I was asking for that consideration because we hear all the time here. I mean, we just heard a bill raising, you know, MAC employees $5 that, you know, have to be paid. So we do it a lot here. So that's why I'm just wondering what we, you know, what was thought through the process. So thank you.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hansen. And I really appreciate the premise to the bill, and hopefully that can be the kind of the focus of continued conversation. Let me just start by saying I have a fair share of experience in this realm and have visited countless different employers, nonprofit organizations, and across especially the general area where I represent in central Minnesota. And to begin with, everyone who helps support individuals with disability believe in dignity, the dignity of life, the dignity that comes with having a job. Mm-hmm. And there's just incredible people, mm-hmm. right? And I'm actually a little bit surprised by the data presented saying that there's only approximately 3,500 people in Minnesota that are at this level, because frankly, I believe there's hundreds in my district. And if we just broke that out to 134 house districts, it would only be 26 people. And I say only, but I believe in the dignity of each and every one of them. I absolutely do. And it would be so unfortunate and disappointing and sad to hear that opportunities are removed from some of the same these same people. And so, Mr. Chair, I was wondering if I could ask a question of one of the testifiers, Ms. Hankner.
Ms. Hankner, if you want to come down. We've got time.
Thank you.
But we don't have all day.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So,
welcome back, Ms. Hankner.
Yes, Mr.
Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question is, you know, there are employers across the state with job openings. Are folks with disabilities forced into sub-minimum wage jobs?
Ms. Hankner.
Mr. Chairman, no, they're not. And the existence of sub-minimum wage does not prohibit anyone from going out to get a minimum wage job if that's what they choose.
Great. Thank
you. Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to have that on the record because whether it's in my community or in Duluth or in Rochester, those opportunities do exist for Minnesotans to get those minimum wage jobs or even higher jobs, right? We've talked around this table how whether it's broadband or whether it's McDonald's, the pay for most folks is above minimum wage in our state. And so when I'm thinking about this, another question that kind of came up for me was just for you, Representative Hansen, what role do you think that the state plays in closing the gap between where employers are currently at versus the state's normal minimum wage?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative, for the question. I think the role the state plays is extremely important. And so I would direct folks to the work of the Human Services Committee last year, where some of those bridges and support systems and safety nets that I mentioned, I could certainly go into all the details here, but I recognize this is not a Human Services Committee, and it might, at the risk of boring you all, it gets really into the weeds there. But the task force report is quite extensive, as is the investments that we made there. I think we play a really important role because it is the government who started 14C contracts, and I think if we as a society are evolving to a place where we agree minimum wage is a dignified, it's an act of dignity and an act of recognizing someone's dignity is to make sure they're getting minimum wage, that the government then also plays a significant role in the transition away from that. We got ourselves into this. We should help us get ourselves out of it as well.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll try and be as specific as possible in this conversation. So let's just say that in 2030, our state's minimum wage has increased and been indexed to inflation, and let's just say that that's $15. Mm-hmm. And under the sub-minimum wage standards today, an individual living with a disability is being paid $5 an hour. What role does the state play in closing that gap versus the employer?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question. So I see where you're going with this, and I recognize that there is seemingly being proposed this idea that the employers who are benefiting from the labor are somehow not able to afford to pay minimum wage to this population, is what I think I'm understanding. And I say they're paying minimum wage to everybody else who works for them. And we have to understand that this has been a cost savings. I will also say that it is important to note that while nonprofits do play a role in this, when you look at financials of some of the nonprofits and the money that goes towards lobbying services or some other things that actively happen here at the Capitol, I can't help but wonder what could one organization do with $500,000 that's saying they can't afford to pay somebody minimum wage but can afford $500,000 in lobbying fees. So as we think about what that looks like in practice, I think we have to grapple with the existence of that reality in addition to the fact that our society agrees minimum wage is the lowest bar for every worker except people with disabilities right now in this context, right? And I'm aware that there are other areas of law that also allow for subminimum wage, and I would also support removing those. We have to move to a place where people with disabilities are not seen as a carve-out, or where their work and their existence in our workforce is not seen as less valuable. And so the role that we can continue to play with employers is a collaborative one. It is reflective of the work that we've done for the last 4 years to bring people to the table and to have the conversations. I said this in the Human Services Committee, and I'll say this here. We've had two classes of legislators who've been elected to this body with eliminating subminimum wage as the top priority for them, because they're disability rights advocates who've been hearing in the disability movement that this is the biggest issue of the decade for a lot of them. And we want to make sure that we're doing our job to listen to those communities. To think that we haven't taken the time to be excessively sensitive and deliberate about this, I think is a misrepresentation of the work that's happened. And I will be as bold as to say that I think it's a misrepresentation of the work of people with disabilities who sat on that task force to be really intentional about that. So I think that's the role government plays in that, is to continue to stay in collaboration with existing employers and nonprofits, for us to be critical of how they're spending their money as it stands today, and then to continue to be there and available and respect the work of people with disabilities that's happened so far.
Representative Schultz.
Mr. Chair, and I was listening to each one of your words, and I thought you started on a really positive lens of trying to answer the question, and then came into the point of questioning the motives of the questions that I was raising. And so I just want to make mention of that, and then also point out that, like, I literally likely represent hundreds of folks in this realm. I represent them. Frankly, they live over an hour away from here, and I am their voice here. They don't have a lobbyist here. They're not lobbying. Frankly, I saw this come up, and I reached out. I reached out to them, and they said that this would result in my citizens not having an opportunity to go to work, to have dignity, purpose, joy, and community that they find by having community with one another, others in the disability community. And instead, they're likely at home, in their apartment, on their own, alone, because those opportunities would cease to exist. We have testimony today, both from people who spoke before us, but also in written testimony, with data that suggests from other states, in addition to the Congressional Budget Office, that the results of this policy, both that have been implemented already and the projections for the way that it would play itself out, would lead to larger increases in joblessness. And that's my concern for folks in the disability community, that the dignity that they get from the job that they have, that option would be off the table for them, and that they would lose the kind of purpose and the joy that's found in their community doing this work. Thank you.
Next person on my list is Representative McDonald. Leader McDonald, do you want to go last or you want to go now?
I'll go last.
Then I have Representative Daniels.
Mr. Chair, Isaac Schultz, Representative Schultz, nailed every point that I was going to make, so I'm going to let him have that, and thank you for bringing all that up.
Next person I have is Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen. We came in together, and I know you've been working on this for the last 4 years, and I know that there's lots of people who've been working on this a lot longer than that, and so just really want to, for the folks who are in this room and have participated in that process over the years, thank you. You know, we heard in this committee this year have been focused on the idea of how do we make the minimum wage really the minimum? And we heard Representative Koslowski's bill eliminating the sub-minimum wage, eliminating the exclusion, the exceptions for the youth wage, for the J-1 visa wage, for the small employer wage, and I think that this fits right in there. Lots of these exceptions are 80-plus years old, rooted in a different vision of people that often does not reflect a value of that I think we all, I think, are voicing here today in terms of how we think about people, how we think about their value to to our state and to our country. And so I more of a statement than a question, but I know that I think you had a response to some of the other stuff that was said, but just really appreciate this, because when we say a minimum wage, it should mean a minimum wage, right? It shouldn't mean a minimum wage except for who you are, how old you are, what disability you have. And so there's a lot of work to do to say, you know, 1085 as a floor is for most folks not affordable, and there's different work to do. But when we have a minimum wage, we should make sure that it impacts everybody. So thank you so much. And I did want to give, I think, Representative Hansen, just if you wanted to, my question is, if you have anything to respond to what we heard.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Greenman, and thank you, Representative Schultz, as well. I do want to respond to your comment. I apologize if you feel that I misrepresented your question. That was not my intention, and I'm happy to have conversation with you about that, and I'm really sorry for misunderstanding. I do want to reiterate that this does not eliminate the opportunities like what was mentioned, and I think that's the most important piece to take away from this. We want to make sure that, like Representative Greenman just said, that minimum wage is minimum wage is minimum wage. That's where we're at. And whatever we have to do to support the providers, the employers, and the people in that between now and 2028, I have given my commitment for the last 4 years, and I'll give it for the next 4 years, that we will continue to do this work. This body has grown and done a really good job of listening to people with disabilities. Your comments reflect that. And I am really happy to hear that, because I too represent a community of a lot of folks with disabilities and providers like this. And that wasn't the case before our generation got to be in this body. So thank you for amplifying the voices of those constituents of yours. They're lucky to have you, because that's not the case that a lot of people around the state have, where their voices are heard in this issue. So that, I just wanted to extend that and the solidarity of thank you for doing that.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I too may have misunderstood Representative Schultz's question, so I'd like to go back to one of the testifiers who testified brilliantly. Just to be clear, there are still programs in which people with disabilities have a place to go where they feel the joy, the dignity, the sense of purpose, that gathering in community and having an opportunity to make a wage gives them. Is it not true that with your bill, that is all still a possibility? There is no part of this bill that takes that away. I see the testifier coming this way. I'd love the clarification one more time.
Ms. Nelson.
Thank you, Representative Berg. Absolutely. There is nothing in this that says that programs have to change, or that how people go to work have to change, how they spend their time has to change. To Representative Schultz, one of the things that we were very sensitive to is we do not want to see people at home in their apartments doing nothing. These programs can stay exactly as they are. How minimum wage is structured under Section 14C is through something called a time study, where people are time studied and rated based on that. And that's how they've been traditionally paid. Where the money would come from to protect these programs maintaining these sheltered workshops is through the contracts they hold. So a day program may hold a contract with a community employer to, let's say, put nuts and bolts in a baggie to go into assembly kits for something. They make that, they organize that contract with that employer to say, okay, this is how much we can do this for. And then the people with disabilities are paid based on their ability level, or how much they produce. Well, to be completely honest, if you paid me based on how many nuts and bolts I could put in a plastic bag, I would also make sub-minimum wage. This limits the type of work people are able to do, which limits the amount of money they're able to make. But to speak to the wage increases, it's not coming from the state. We're not asking businesses to subsidize it themselves. It's all about recontracting. LifeWorks did this a number of years ago, and they're a business here. They maintained out of all of their contracts from subminimum wage when they left subminimum wage and continued doing the same type of employment, they maintained 90% of their contracts. 90% of their contracts said, yeah, we're going to support you. We believe that paying people a dignified wage is a meaningful thing to do. So, yeah, we'll pay more for this contract so that you can pay people disabilities minimum wage. We're not saying that these doors need to close. We're not saying that the type of work needs to happen. We're simply saying people with disabilities deserve minimum wage. And to cite this idea that people enter this in choice, we have to look at the questions they're being asked. No one is coming up to them and saying, do you want to make $4 an hour or do you want to make $10.85 an hour? They're saying, do you want to continue to work here with your friends in this program or do you want to go find another job? That's the question they're being asked. So if someone asked you, do you want to work with the coworkers you love and enjoy, or do you want to go try something new? That's a very different question than, do you want to make 7 cents an hour, or do you want to make minimum wage? I would be very hard struck to find any human being that if you said, do you want me to pay you $1 an hour, or do you want me to pay you $10 an hour, that would take that dollar.
I said earlier, we have lots of time. And we're running out of that quickly, but Representative Berg.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and thank you for clarifying that. So the folks that enjoy their where they gather in their community to do the work that they do, and that is what feels good and right and healing for them, still have that opportunity, is what I'm hearing you say. For folks who may be alone, maybe, our other testifier, it seems like there's an abundance of blessing where the family is able to care for their loved ones. And that wouldn't that be the best case scenario that we could all have the ability to care for our loved ones in that manner? However, I think the reality shows that there are many people in the disability community that are alone, that are their sole responsibility is their own survival. And so that opportunity is severely limited if they are subjected to subminimum wages. So what I'm hearing with this bill is it provides space for everyone, for those that like to be in the facility where they feel most comfortable, still there. For families that are able to care for their loved ones and help them find purpose and joy, still there. For those that are alone and facing abject poverty, this is a chance to survive. This is a chance to thrive, to fulfill that sense of dignity, purpose, and joy. Thank you, Representative Hansen, for this work. I know you've been doing it since before either one of us were here, and I'm really happy to see this get a hearing and for your efforts and outreach to the community to bring an understanding to all of us. Thank you.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've heard this bill since 2019, or variations thereof. There's been very passionate testimony on both sides of this. I believe in 2019, was a young lady, probably 25, motorized wheelchair, has to have a chaperone the whole time she does anything, begged us not to do this, began to cry. She had a very passionate 10-minute speech. With this gets, and I'm watching the two people that testified against this that have children in this arena, which often these programs give them a break for a few hours a day. Am I correct?
I see head shaking.
Yeah, that's all I needed. We don't have time to keep bringing people back and forth. I think everybody here would agree that there are going to be some people hurt by this. They will lose the opportunity, or they can simply just go volunteer and not get anything. And they can still be participate in a program. None of you may know, I have a sibling in this arena. And if you talk about loved ones taking care of them, she's about to lose that. And we have to figure out what we're going to do with her, because my dad is not doing so well. And he's doing exactly what they have to do. And she doesn't have the ability to drive. She doesn't have the ability to work. So she can do these little things like what these programs are, or she could before until they move, because now there's not one in her neighborhood anymore. But you are going to take that away from her. Mr. Chair, is your intent to put this in the omnibus bill?
Representative Mecklen, right now we're going to lay this over. I believe this would be in another bill from another committee. It's outside of our jurisdiction.
Mr. Chair, I move to table this bill on account that this will harm people irreparably. And until those items are figured out, I would ask for a roll call.
Motion was made to table the bill. Roll call being asked for. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Nelson.
No.
Chair Nelson votes no. Vice Chair Berg.
No.
Vice Chair Berg votes no. Lead McDonald.
Aye.
Lead McDonald votes aye. Representative Daniels.
Aye.
Representative Daniel votes aye. Representative Greenman.
No.
Representative Greenman votes no. Representative Hill. Representative Hill is excused. Representative Hussein.
No.
Representative Hussein votes no. Representative Jordan.
No.
Representative Jordan votes no. Representative Kozlowski.
No.
Representative Kozlowski votes no. Representative Meckland.
Aye.
Representative Meckland votes aye. Representative Myers.
Aye.
Representative Myers votes aye. Representative Schultz.
Aye.
Representative Schultz votes aye. Representative Wolgamott.
No.
Representative Wolgamott votes no. There are 5 ayes and 7 nays.
5 ayes and 7 nays. Then. The motion does not prevail. Next person on my list, or the last person on my list, is Representative McDonald.
No, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, if you would be so kind to clarify something you said just a bit ago when you were answering, I think, Representative Berg's comments. Something about the legislature, those in the disability community didn't have a voice in the legislature until your bill or something like that. Can you clarify that comment?
Representative Hansen, I think.
Thank you, Chair. I was complimenting Representative Schultz for advocating for people with disabilities, because it is not a voice that we've heard broadly as a person with a disability. It is encouraging to hear both sides of the aisle standing up for people with disabilities, and it's exciting. And I was complimenting Representative Schultz on that.
Representative McDonald.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Hansen. And it's encouraging that you're taking up the mantra for the disability community. But please be aware that those of us who've been here for a long time, Representative Nelson, I've been here 14 years, and in that 14 years, people ask me, what's the greatest thing you've done down here? Or what's your proudest accomplishment? And this has been for the disability community. It's not something that you can really pinpoint to a major legislation, because it's the help of many folks, the Democrats and Republicans, a lot of work in HHS, and then working with the Senator Hoffman. But the voices of those in the disability community have been heard and listened to, and we've been doing great work for many years, long before your team got here. But I appreciate the that you guys are picking up the work as well and joining the club of us who've been working hard for the disability community. So I just wanted to clarify that. That's not what I wanted to talk about, but when you said that, I think you know that you're not the only one that has been working hard for the disability community. There's been many more, including my father, who was here for 14 years back in the 1970s up until 1990. So I hope you know that, and I hope you are hearing that message. One thing I didn't hear from the testifiers or anyone in your camp or in your testimony is talking to employers who hire the folks with disabilities. Mm-hmm. And the question that I have first, under the 14C, the Department of Labor, if that is eliminated with your amendment, does that then also eliminate any federal funding that goes to employers?
Representative Hansen.
Chair, I would defer to my testifier. This is a pretty technical question, and I think somebody working directly on this will have a better answer to it.
Ms. Nelson, I think you mentioned LifeWorks before, so Ms. Nelson.
The Section 14C certificate does not actually provide any federal funding to any of these programs. It just allows them to pay below minimum wage by meeting certain time study and commensurate pay levels. But there's no funding tied to that use.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then there's state funding as well that employers are able to grant money, receive?
Absolutely. Most of these programs, these day programs, the funding that is being received is actually through Minnesota Medicaid funds. So Minnesota Medicaid is funding paying people below minimum wage at this point. None of that funding would go away. It would just be switched to a different. In fact, competitive and integrated and customized employment actually has higher reimbursement rates through different Medicaid programs and waiver systems than just day treatment and rehabilitation programs.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you for clarifying. That's good to hear. I won't repeat some of the words that my colleagues have said, but long before I got to this legislature, I also was on the board of directors for REM in the Wright County area. It's a group home for disability. So I'm very in tune to the needs and the great things that the disability community and the legislature and those who care about them are doing for folks, especially many that are being included in community. And that's when a lot of my work has been. But never in, I think, the 14 years that I hear that subminimum wage was their number one priority. Many employers, as you are aware, that hire many folks with disabilities, some pay them minimum wage. Mm-hmm. I have a friend that's, I was in communicating just today. He's hiring four employees this month and I think another six next month. And this gentleman is paying him full wage, minimum wage. But he is getting a grant from the government that'll help subsidize that, because he did say that some of the employees that he hires with disabilities are doing, he said they're 45% less productive. But he didn't care. He wanted to hire them at full price anyway, because he knows the beauty of hiring someone with disabilities and it gives them an opportunity. What we hear from several employers, and including Representative Schultz, is they very well could lose many, many jobs because of this, and that would be a shame. Are you aware that in Maine, when they passed in 2018, they eliminated their sub-minimum wage, and they lost their numbers stated that in 2018, two-thirds of the disabled employees are now unemployed, two-thirds. That's not good news. I hope that doesn't happen in Minnesota. I know that all of you don't hope that happens. Furthermore, those who are still working 12 hours a week in Washington, 80% were unemployed in Washington when they passed this legislation. And then in Vermont also, there are fewer disabled adults supporting employment since they enacted that in 2002. So we do have cause to concern that with your legislation, many those in the disability community will be unemployed. And employers who, out of the sometimes the gracious of their hearts, because employers are business owners who care about their community and hiring folks in and giving them an opportunity in a life and that they should enjoy every beauty that you and I enjoy, may just lose that. And the evidence is in many other states.
Can I respond, Chair Nelson?
Representative Hansen.
Chair Nelson, I would also defer to Jillian, because she has studied the models in other states. As a co-chair of the task force, we are doing our best to learn from these mistakes, and I don't want that to go understated. I hear the concerns. We've heard the concerns. As Representative Mecklen said, this conversation's been going on for a very long time. There are a number of us in this body who have similar experiences to what folks have said. I have a friend with a disability, or I have a son or a loved one or a brother, but we don't talk about it the same way. And so I just want to be sensitive to the fact that there are some people who have had this experience firsthand, and what's being shared about, you know, different people's loved ones doesn't, the absence of the storytelling doesn't mean the absence of existence of families who do support this. And so I just wanted to put that out there, but I would defer to my testifier to talk about the models and
Ms. Nelson, we don't have time. Succinctly.
I've been sitting in every single hearing since 2019 when this was brought forward by four self-advocates. I'm one of those four self-advocates. In 2019, I spoke to this as emergency, when we, the original legislation called to create the task force, and I spoke to it as emergency preparedness. We saw that the other 14 states had passed this law. We saw what had happened. We knew that this was an interest of the federal government. We know that there are individual groups here in Minnesota talking about bringing forth litigation to end subminimum wage, such as happened in other states that have eliminated it. And the task force became so important at that point because I didn't want what had happened in those other states, such as Maine and Vermont, to happen here in Minnesota, which is why we convened a task force. It's why we met with all of those states. We heard about what happened there, and we created models to support providers in successfully transitioning to maintain their and keep their doors open. That was the utmost priority to me. In fact, the other three self-advocates that began this project with me, they wanted to just call for a sunset date. No planning, no process. And I said, we cannot do that. There are thousands and thousands of people in Minnesota that depend on these day programs, that depend on these supports. And if we go forward ending subminimum wage without a plan, we're going to lose those programs. We created a plan. The Minnesota legislature invested in that plan. And now it's time to follow the belief of that plan and end subminimum wage in Minnesota. We have done all of our due diligence. When we closed the institutions in Minnesota, we heard the same things. Where will my people go? They won't be welcome in the community. They will fail. Your own time in REM has shown you that people with disabilities thrive when we believe in them. If we continue to tell them they can't, that they're not worth this, that this isn't possible, then it won't be possible. But we have done every single ounce of due diligence to make this possible and to allow every single employer to be successful in making this transition and to restore human dignity to all people with disabilities who are a member of our working community.
And Rep. Hansen, you want to wrap up, and then we will lay this bill over.
I'll respect your time, Chair, and just thank you all for the robust discussion. I appreciate the transparency of your concerns and the respect for hearing me out about the work that's happened. I know not everybody can be in all the spaces like our testifier has been in every single space. And so, like I said, I did my best to summarize 90 years of history of this and many years of active work here at the legislature. And just want to also say thank you to everyone who shares their personal stories. I understand that none of us are owed access to your personal lives like that or your personal experiences, but you choosing to share those with us in this setting really is impactful and meaningful, and I would like to say thank you for that, and thank you for your time today.
With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 2530 be laid over. And members, with that, our agenda is complete, and we're adjourned.